Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe, and this is today's Ryan.
Hi.
Justin.
I'm Justin.
Again. We talked about the revolving door of hosts thing last week. That's not happening quite yet. I do have somebody lined up for a future episode, and I'm hoping it'll be the next one, so be on the lookout for that. For those of you who missed last week's episode, Ryan's on a bit of an extended hiatus from the show, although I am hoping he'll be back for a review on Legend of Vox Machina sometime at the end of October. But for today, Justin and I bring you our leisure lists for the last couple months, which once again, for those of you who somehow don't know, is a potpourri of entertainment where we try to give you non-spoiler reviews of whatever we're watching, listening to, or reading. I'll kick things off. At the end of July, you and I both watched Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, because Justin has never seen any of the Star Trek movies, and I haven't seen a good chunk of them. I have seen Wrath of Khan, though, so this one was a rewatch for me. And still just as exceptional as I remember it. It's tension is the name of the game in this one. The entire thing is basically two captains on their starships trying to outwit each other for 2 hours. And what I appreciate about this movie is the maturity behind it. This is effectively Kirk's midlife crisis movie, where at the start of the movie, he's feeling old and ineffectual and, you know, I'm not in the prime of my life anymore. I'm moving on to a new era that I'm not really looking forward to. I yearn to be young again, be out in the stars and get into adventures. But he's just sort of depressed about this point in his life. And this plot is effectively all the mistakes of his youth coming back to bite him in the ass by the time he's middle-aged. It's reckoning with who you used to be as a man and who you are now and who you wish to be going forward and your legacy and what you've left behind in this world. For whatever you've done in your life, it's very thematically powerful movie and just plain entertaining to see Ricardo Montalban and William Shatner spar off each other for a couple hours, despite them never even sharing a single scene of screen time in the same room. That's the craziest thing about this one.
Now that you mention that, that is pretty impressive.
Their entire relationship's basically over Skype, like, or Discord, like we're doing now. Not sponsored, but yeah, it's video chat the entire film, which is nuts. So, yeah, what'd you think of Wrath of Khan?
It was good. I went in with the expectations of, like, you know, we just watched the first one not that long before, and, you know, it was okay. Wasn't overly impressed with it, but this one was definitely a step above the first one. It was really, really good.
Although I'm sure you were anticipating another 15-minute sequence of going around the Enterprise.
It was shorter this time.
Running joke we had between all these Star Trek movies of the original cast is every time we saw the Enterprise for the first time, we're just, oh, is this going to be another really extended shot of admiring the ship like in the first one? I think in terms of movies, Wrath of Khan might be the biggest ever step up I've seen from a sequel compared to an original. In terms of just sheer entertainment value and filmmaking and acting and just like everything was a cut above in Wrath of Khan. As far as a complete package goes.
It almost feels like going from producing like a TV show to creating the first film, it's like they learned what needed to be done to make it more of a film rather than a TV show that's really extended length.
That's a good point. The Star Trek The Motion Picture feels like an episode of the original series that's an hour too long, where Star Trek Wrath of Khan feels like a legitimate movie through and through, which they, you're right, I guess they did need that stumbling block there to hone their skills and figure out what they were doing with this franchise on the big screen. Those TV sort of concepts didn't translate as well to film, so they needed to go for, all right, let's go for a little more action heavy sort of deal, because that's more palatable for movie audiences. So keeping in the Star Trek vein here, we'll go on to Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, which is trying not to spoil these movies, mind you, but The Search for Spock picks up right after The Wrath of Khan, and Spock is, well, effectively missing, and missing in action, and the rest of the Enterprise crew have to find him. But Starfleet's not really having it this time around. And since the crew is either retired or mostly retired by this point, that's wrong. The crew wasn't retired. They retired the Enterprise and hadn't built the new one yet. They were effectively going to get replaced. So the old crew spends the first half of the movie basically carjacking the Enterprise out of Starfleet dry dock. And that's the best part of the movie, is the first half of like these middle-aged guys doing a heist. Just like,
yeah, that was
on
cool.
Starfleet. That was the most intriguing part of Search for Spock, is that Starfleet were sort of the antagonists in the first half of the movie. And then the back half got notably less interesting, although Christopher Lloyd was incredibly magnetic as a villain, as a Klingon captain. So I'd say Search for Spock is still worth a watch, but it does falter in its second half. Whereas Wrath of Khan's a must-see.
I actually liked Search for Spock. I thought it was pretty good. Maybe that's a controversial opinion. I'm not sure. I thought it was pretty good. Not as good as Wrath of Khan, but having gone through quite a few of the movies now, I actually liked that one quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest issues with it, is that it's the one after Wrath of Khan. It's not a bad movie by any stretch. If you were to just watch Search for Spock, it's good. But because it's the direct sequel to Wrath of Khan and everyone's expectations were sky high, I can see why to people then and now it's a little bit of a disappointment. But as an individual Star Trek movie and just a movie in general, still worth a watch, personally. So you should do one now.
All right. Well, first on my list, I've got I rewatched Star Wars: The Force Awakens because my girlfriend had never seen it yet, We watched that again. And you know, it's not as good as I remember. Like the parts I remember, you know, I haven't seen it since its theater release, basically
9 years ago.
And the parts that I distinctly remember about it, that I was like, oh yeah, these are super cool. And I'm like waiting to see what my girlfriend thinks when she sees it. And I'm like, oh, this was I remember this being cooler. It was a little underwhelming this time.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why that is, but.
My thing with The Force Awakens is that the entire movie, the word I'd use to describe it is potential. That's what I think of with The Force Awakens. This movie isn't that complete when you take it as a standalone picture. It was very dependent on setting up the story or getting threads together, which would ultimately supposed to have been paid off in episode 8 and 9. And that's why, even at the time, I sort of ignored that it doesn't really stand on its own 2 feet, because it was just a really fun movie, and it still is. It's a great action-adventure. The effects still hold up. It was sort of a harbinger for a return to practical effects in Hollywood at the time. I remember that was a huge talking point. You get your doses of nostalgia with Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford, and all the new cast are great. Oscar Isaac, Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, all fantastic newcomers. And it's just this air of... It was a breath of fresh air for Star Wars at the time. But the general consensus was, okay, we're leaning a lot on nostalgia for this one, but now that we've gotten the overly familiar out of the way, let's see where it goes. And it didn't stick the landing. So Force Awakens has always been a little more tarnished on rewatch for me, just because it's the setup movie for a payoff I didn't care for. I'm just curious, what did Wei think of it, having not seen the payoff? Is my line of thinking tracking along that, or is that just a me thing?
She thought it was pretty good, like not yeah. bad, not the best one, but I think it definitely shows still, even to somebody new. I think that idea of it being a new Star Wars movie and the hype behind it being new at the time when we watched it really added to its value. And, you know, we hadn't seen a Star Wars movie or any Star Wars anything in a really long time.
It had been like 10 live years action before that. Yeah. Since Revenge of the Sith came out. Force Awakens to this day is still probably my favorite theatrical movie going experience, where me and most of my best friends got to be at the front of the line at the little local theater and see the first Star Wars movie in 10 years. And this is like a second run theater who never got brand new movies, but they somehow snagged a screening of Force Awakens opening night on the Thursday. And you could feel the buzz for everybody. That's one of the last times I've ever probably, like, Avengers Endgame was probably the next big one where I got that sort of feeling where just everybody was looking forward to this, where there wasn't a single person I knew who wasn't at least interested. Even people who weren't Star Wars fans kind of got caught up in the hype at the time. This is one of those experiences that's going to be pretty hard to ever replicate again in today's media landscape. So despite what I think of the movie, I do still cherish that build up and first experiences with it, and those, you know, couple years of all the theories. Oh, and I forgot to mention Adam Driver as Kylo Ren. Yeah, he's the highlight of all those movies.
Yeah. No, I think the one thing that still stands out for it is the visual effects and just the filmmaking in general. If you kind of turn your brain off and just look at it, it's a really good looking movie. It looks fantastic. Yeah. And it's the production design, you know, it's not a terrible movie.
Yeah, I tend to think of the colors in that one. They pop really nicely. I like the palettes, and it's not taking itself too seriously. The action's kinetic and fun. The lightsaber fights are a little weakly choreographed, but whatever. I've got my gripes with it, but I generally still enjoy The Force Awakens. Yeah. So let me know when you watch the next two. That'll probably be on a future installment of Leisure Lists. We'll get back to that.
Eventually, yeah.
Watch the close-up Defending the Sequels episode we did a while back. Got a whole video on why the sequels, I don't want to say they aren't as bad as you think, but like, we did our best to pick out the good from them, because there was plenty. My next up here is Cobra Kai Season 6, Part 1. I'm just going to complain right off the bat that Netflix is doling out this last season that I've waited years for into three separate parts. Whose idea was that? That's just infuriating for consumers. Just, even if you don't know the show, you can probably sympathize with my frustration here. But how was Part 1? Anyway, it was a pretty good start. I am going to try not to spoil the other five seasons, I guess. But basically, there's a brand new status quo. And shockingly for this show, it's actually sticking. And it's a refreshing change of pace to see most of the characters finally mostly getting along now, and a lot of the arcs they've gone through over the last 5 years are finally paying off, and a new era is upon them all, and it really feels like the start of something new, and also the beginning of the end, this being the final season of the show. But I also enjoy them sort of rewriting the history of the Karate Kid as well a little bit with Daniel's plot line, where he starts uncovering these secrets about Mr. Miyagi he never knew, that Miyagi had this life that he never told Daniel about when he was a young man, and Daniel sort of coming to terms with he didn't know everything about this mentor that he's idolized his entire life. That's very intriguing stuff. Normally, I don't go in for the rewrites like that of previous history, but Cobra Kai has always been respectful of its source and always done things in a way that feels organic to the world, and it's never steered me wrong yet, so I'm willing to see it through and looking forward to the Sekai Taikai, which I'm hoping will kick off in part two. So pretty darn good so far. Next up is Hidden Strike, which I don't think I've ever seen John Cena lead a movie before, but I thought he was excellent in Peacemaker, so sure, John Cena, Jackie Chan, seems like a strange combination, but let's go for it. Why not? I thought they had good chemistry together. They definitely have distinctly different action styles. Jackie Chan's always sort of had that thing he does where he's both badass and comedic at the same time. He manages to do physical comedy and look awesome doing it. Whereas John Cena is a little bit more typical American action hero. He's more of a bit more of a bruiser, but he's also a tactical mind, mercenary sort of guy. I remember the camera movements in those action scenes being pretty nauseating, though, because they just did this thing where they go round and round and round and round. And I'm like, ugh, I'm on a roller coaster here. Just knock it off. Can you film action another way, please? And the film in general is just cheesy and goofy. It's got pretty poor special effects, and it's not a great story or anything. Nothing you haven't really seen before. Jackie Chan's trying to save his daughter. And there was some plot about an oil rig or something, and mercenaries in the Middle East. Everyone's vying for resources. It's just fine. I mean, it's all right if you turn your brain off. It's nothing too special, but it was entertaining, for sure. So, yeah, what's your next?
Well, rolling off that, I also watched a John Cena movie. Jackpot. Amazon Prime original. it's John Cena and Awkwafina. You know, it's same kind of thing. It's not, you know, it's nothing special, but it was pretty enjoyable. The comedy feels a little forced sometimes, like they're really trying hard with the jokes, and maybe if they backed off on that a bit and just rolled with the story, it probably could have been a great movie. Mostly it's not John Cena or Awkwafina, it's more the rest of the cast. Simon Liu is good as well. I'm butchering his name, but the three main actors are really good in it. They stand out, but all the supporting cast is where it kind of falls down. It's not terrible because it's mostly focused on, obviously, the three leads. You know, it's another one. You turn your brain off and it's not bad.
It's an pretty good movie.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's just nothing special, that's all.
There's something to be said for action movies like that, where it's just, yeah, I know the actors, and it's not a train wreck. It's just something to put on in the background, I guess. Just, it's, oh, I caught a joke in that if I was kind of paying attention. Sure. Those are all right.
The concept was cool, too. Like, it was an interesting concept. The whole, you know, win the lottery, but everybody's trying to kill you for the ticket. That's the setup for the movie.
That's a cool premise.
And it's like, legally, anybody can kill you. You just gotta survive, right?
It's one of those ones I can understand why a movie gets made off a premise like that. But does it stick the landing? Well, most of the time, no. Which is unfortunate. I'm one of those people who love to see remakes of movies that had great premises and failed to deliver instead of what we get now, which is remakes of stuff that was already pretty good the first time. So something like that were to get remade and take a step up, I'd be interested. Next up,
For something like that, I don't know if it could be remade any better. I think the concept would have to be put into a totally different genre. Like, maybe comedy doesn't really do it justice. Mm-hmm. But for the concept and for the genre, I think they did as good as they could get with it. But, you know, maybe a different genre could do the same idea and play it off better.
I like that idea. Why does a remake have to be confined to the genre from which it originated? Do something wildly different if you're going to bother remaking things. Next up for me is Full Metal Jacket. And yeah, this one's really good. Although I will say it's sort of a Search for Spock situation where the movie is effectively in two distinct halves, and I liked one considerably better. The first chunk of the movie where all the new recruits are in basic training is impeccable in every way. I've got nothing bad to say about that stuff. The slow indoctrination of these rowdy young men into discipline killing machines who will unhesitatingly follow orders. It's about how the military complex breaks down free will and turns you into soldiers to fight for your country and your superiors and your fellow soldiers, and, you know, leave critical thinking at the door, leave your individuality. When they, in scene one, when they shave off your hair on the floor, everybody's uniform wears the same clothes, exactly, has the same guns, same haircuts. It's all about conformism and uniformity, and that's incredible. And then the back half where they actually go to Vietnam and fighting, well, then it just becomes a full-on war movie at that point. The action scenes are tense and gritty, and I love the long takes and the tracking shots used in the filmmaking. They were very effective at just at conveying the scenes. It's like, oh, wow, this is pretty crazy. Oh, and they're still going. Oh, I feel like any one of them's good. It nearly puts you in the action along with the soldiers who are getting blown up all around the screen, and not cutting around gives you less time, gives you more time to process what you're seeing. Cutting around is nearly like, oh, it's nearly glamorizing it to cut around things too much, because you're trying to show different angles of it, and it nearly feels more like, oh, I'm doing this for entertainment. But long takes, framed right, feel more documentarian in style, in a way. With, like, you know, it's special effects work, but it's more visceral. Standout of the movie is, of course, Arlie Emery's Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, who is the main antagonist of the first half, which, once again, super fascinating that the main antagonist of the first half is your superior officer. And even though he's really on your side and just mentally and physically abusing you, he is still, this is the guy you will fight and die for once you are fighting the enemy across seas. So it's very, there's a lot to this movie, and it's a must-see for sure. One of the best war movies I've ever seen. And for something completely different, my next one is The Incredibles 2, which I somehow missed at the time it came out. I guess I was just, actually, I don't think I really saw a heck of a lot of animation in the last 15 years. I grew up on a lot of Pixar stuff, including The Incredibles. Then somewhere in the 2010s, I just sort of stopped watching a lot of those. So you know, now's the time I'm getting caught up on some of them, including Incredibles 2. I greatly respect the decision to kick things off right the moment the first one ended. They didn't do any skip forwards of any significant amount of time. They just hit the ground running with that 20-year-old cliffhanger and carried on from the organic aftermath of the first movie. And it's one of those situations where you'd think, oh, well, it's a 20-year-on delayed sequel, and we've seen a lot of those by now, and most of them are disappointing at best, complete train wrecks at worst. Well, I don't want to say disappointing at best. The good ones are really good. And, well, that's my point. This one's one of the good ones. It's just a good story. I like how they focus more on Helen this time around, because Bob was more the protagonist of the first movie, and this time we're getting more of the focus on the matriarch of the clan as she's doing her superheroing and getting all the limelight, while Bob is a stay-at-home dad who finds out that being a single parent is harder in many ways than fighting the bad guys. So it's sort of a fun parallel where the stay-at-home mom has to go back to work, and the dad who has been working all these years has to stay at home, and they sort of see the other side of each other's lives, which is great. The plot was a little predictable. I could see where quite a few of the overall plot lines were heading, but it was super impressive animation and a thoroughly entertaining and unique superhero movie in an era where you'd think you had have seen everything the genre had to offer by this point. But Incredibles 2 is one of those ones, like the first movie, that shows the genre really just needs a good shot of creative energy, someone with a vision that isn't cookie cutter or looking to just sell a brand or an IP or set up a universe. It's Brad Bird loves this world and his characters, and he created a sequel to a beloved classic, and it's got artistic integrity. And I greatly respect it and enjoyed this one. Yeah, you've seen this one, right?
Yeah, I saw it. I'm a child, so I saw it back when it came out. So it's been a while for me, but I remember liking it quite a bit. Starting where they left off was excellent.
So what do you got next?
So it's been said on this podcast once before, I know, but I listen to lots of audiobooks. So recently I listened to the Three Body Problem trilogy. People will recognize that Netflix has done their first season that's supposed to be the covering the first book. So I listened to all three of the books. Mm-hmm. The first one is pretty good. As far as I understand, Netflix is doing a pretty loose adaption, like blending some characters, splitting some characters up. The book has one lead character, which has been split into several pieces for the Netflix version, and they've kind of blended things in from the later books, so it's all in timeline order. But yeah, the first book is pretty good. The sci-fi, it's like a grounded sci-fi, and it's the concept's cool. The characters are cool. Everything's pretty interesting. It's very wordy and very science-based. So it's not for everyone, but
it's more hard sci-fi, right?
Yeah, it's hard sci-fi. And Netflix, I've seen two of the episodes from the Netflix series, and it seems like they've taken the core ideas and the core storyline, and they're making it more approachable for general audiences.
That's all right.
And so, the second book is hands down my favorite one out of the three. It's excellent. I can't say too much about it because I also don't want to spoil anything for anybody who's watching like the Netflix show or anything. It's the lead character in that book is excellent. The concept is excellent. Everything about it it's actually one of the best audiobooks I've listened to in a long time. It's very, very good.
That's saying something.
It keeps you hooked the whole way through.
This guy listens to audiobooks 8 hours a day. Pretty 5 days a week. He's lucky to have a job where he can concentrate on his job and listen to audiobooks while he's going. So
yeah, it's good. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
So the third book is good as well. It's probably about the same as the first one. It's not at, like, the second one is clearly the best one. Some people argue the third one's better. But I think it's more the protagonist of the third book is rather unlikable. But you do get to see some concepts come back and some characters from the second one come in, which was a lot different from the first one because the first book, basically, you don't see pretty much any of those characters don't matter anymore. But so when it came to the second and the third books, you know, some characters crossed over and some characters still had a part to play, which was really cool seeing the ends of some of their stories because it is the last book in the series. But,
based on what you told me, these books thematically seemed to deal a lot with the collective versus the individual, and just how groupthink often gets the planet in trouble, whereas it's the individuals who always end up seeming to save the day in these, or screw people up. They either save the day or screw everyone over pretty royally, but the collective always seems to never move anything forward. So you either get the extremes.
Yeah, and that idea is hammered out, especially in the last book. It's very clear, the message. And it sticks to that theme pretty well. It keeps it interesting, even though if you've picked up on the theme by the second book, the third book still carrying with the same theme, you still can't predict what's going on. Like, these books, right to the end, like, you have no idea what's going on. Not like you're confused, but you can't exactly predict where it's going to go, because the characters in the book are very, very intelligent. Like, they are very, very smart. They come up with very creative ideas. So,
yeah, basically, no, what you told me, it sounds pretty twisty. There were a lot of, you've explained a lot of the plot to me, and there was a lot of great twists in there. Just unexpected things happening, and good uses of foreshadowing and payoffs that happen way later for things that you might not.
Yeah, pretty anticipate. Much everything. Everything is important.
Yeah.
That happens. Like, everything connects later on or something. Like, there's everything that kind of pops up. There's something you can go back to, and you're always like, oh, man. It's not like it was, oh, that was so obvious. How did I not know that? No, it's like, oh, that's amazing that it was set up earlier. But there's no way from that piece of information at the beginning that you'd be like, that you could tell what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It keeps you guessing, definitely. And I'm excited to see what Netflix does with it. I'm glad there's also the Chinese adaption of it, which is staying more faithful to the actual books. It's pretty well more of a straight adaption, where Netflix is doing a lot of mixing and doing their thing with it. So it'll be interesting. I'm probably going to watch both just to see, because I really do like the books in their original form. But I'm also curious to see what Netflix does to kind of make it easier for the general audience, too.
Yeah. So another one for me, I actually played a video game in the last few months. I beat Dark Forces, the original game from the mid-90s. Gave the world Kyle Katarn. For those of you who don't know, he was Finn before Finn was a thing. Pretty well the basis for Finn, as far as I'm concerned. But Dark Forces, you find out that, I don't remember if you figured out he was a former stormtrooper in this one. I think they did mention that he did used to be Imperial. So he's a former stormtrooper turned mercenary, and he's helping out the rebellion. The very first mission on this is him stealing the Death Star plans. So I'm like, okay, well, before Rogue One, it was this guy who did it pretty well, single-handed. So I should go back a second, though. So Dark Forces is effectively a Doom clone when Doom was still the very beginning of Doom. So it's Doom, but in Star Wars. It's a first-person shooter with a bunch of Star Wars-themed weapons. You're just killing Imperials on unique planets every level. Navigation on these planets is pretty painful without the map, though, because every planet's got these maze-like designs. But I do quite enjoy the environments they set up, though, because every place has a unique vibe to it. Every planet's got its own character, so to speak. And there isn't really a ton of character work in this game, because there's brief cutscenes between some of the levels, but and Kyle Katarn doesn't really talk a whole lot while he's infiltrating these Imperial complexes and killing entire battalions single-handedly. But in the go-betweens between the levels, you get a little bit of Kyle and Jen, just mostly through their voice acting in the game. You just kind of, they have this playful banter sometimes. It's subtle, but it does build out their relationship nicely. The running and gunning is a heck of a lot of fun in this game, but it's challenging for me because I suck at shooters. It's one of those classic style games where you don't regenerate health. You have to pick up health packets and shields and extra lives. And if you die too many times, oopsie, you got to restart the level. No. I save scummed it. I threw on unlimited live cheats. I'm like, no, I'm not playing the game that way. Can't do it. Sorry, I'm not a purist that way. I need to be able to enjoy the game a little bit, and those kind of challenges just don't do it for me in this genre. So, I've heard the sequels are better, though. I can't say I really recommend this game unless you're into classic shooters. It, you know, graphically, it's very dated. But, yeah, I had some fun with it. I mostly just liked that it was a short game, because I'm sick of modern games having to be 60 hours long at bare minimum. I'm like, you know, I got through this game in a dozen hours and had a good time. So it's good fun if you turn your brain off, except use your brain during the puzzles, because those are kind of hard. And I also read a book, for one. This one's called The Movies of the 80s by Ron Bass and David Haslam. And it's a very thorough breakdown of 1980s cinema from the main most popular movies of the decade, the most popular actors and producers, just what was happening in Hollywood at that time, how is it changing for the better and for worse, what elements of film were being pushed or regressed, and how did the 1980s change the filmmaking industry? Largely speaking, people just got more ambitious, more greedy, and way worse with money. Commercialism became king over art, and it worked in large part. So, yeah, that's a pretty brief summation. But yeah, the book was pretty good. I recommend it if you're a fan of trivial knowledge of movies and like 80s cinema in particular. So, what's up for you?
Well, I watched a Korean show on Netflix called Chicken Nugget. Just reading through the premise made me chuckle a little bit. I was like, there's no way this show sounds ridiculous. The premise basically just says, a girl steps into a machine and turns into a chicken nugget. And I was like, what? How? Like, is this seriously, like, is this going to be the whole show? Is this being serious about it? And I watched the first episode. This show is ridiculous. It's not for everyone, but I really liked it. The visual effects side of it is definitely really, really weak. Like, it looks like I've seen, I haven't seen anything that bad before in a production like this. Because the rest of the production looks gorgeous. It looks spectacular. Like, it looks, it has the K-drama look to it. It's not a Hollywood look, but it's very clean looking. The colors pop. It's very, very good, the production wise. And then you have these really, really bad VFX, which actually adds to it, I find, because it's hilarious how bad they are.
It's so ridiculous.
And the characters
already
are so over the top.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
The effects may as well be bad, too.
Yeah. The characters are way over the top. The story is ridiculous. There's all sorts of... A new character will come in and be like... Have a very long-winded, sidetracked, like... Flash... Like, cutaway to their whole story. And it's funny. It's good. The concept is true to it. It's the girl turns into a chicken nugget, and her father and the guy who works at the office with him are trying to figure out how to turn her back, and it goes wild and out there, and it was fun. It was great. I thought it was just going to be stupid, because sometimes I put stupid things on and I enjoy them, and this was actually pretty darn good. If you can get past the humor of it, it's definitely not for everyone.
Yeah, that's one thing I always respect you for, is trying out the weird stuff that a lot of people might just scroll by. My viewing habits tend to view more towards things people that watch en masse that I've heard of. Because I feel like I just got this big back catalog of stuff I've heard of I need to get through before I start branching out into weird stuff. But yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed that one. It's one I might watch someday, just on a whim. But so I watched Donnie Darko, which I'd always heard was pretty weird as well, speaking of. And... really had no idea what to expect, other than it stars a young Jake Gyllenhaal and there's a demonic bunny thing in it. Sure, why not? I loved it. It's got incredible dialogue, and I love all the actors in it too. Even the side characters had personality. Everything feels so... the world just feels lived in, and everyone, the characters in it all feel three-dimensional in a way that I'm not used to seeing. It's just, the script was very, very well done. This is another film, kind of like your three-body problem, that is a lot about conformism versus individualism, and the status quo being the town and the local leaders trying to crush the individual and dumb down complex topics so that the kids of the town don't really critically engage with stuff. Basically, whenever the characters try to critically engage with things, they get shut down and told very simple answers, and how dare you even ask these questions? Like, there's these unspoken rules that everyone's... It was a lot... There was a lot of religious base on that, for that element. But, like, how dare you question the local preacher kind of guy? But it was also largely about this one teenager's serious mental health struggles and trying to belong in his community, in his school. He doesn't really have a lot of friends. He's kind of a weird guy. It's also about how these small town communities that seem pretty innocent and moral, a lot of the leaders have hidden dark sides to them as well, which what happens when that gets brought to light? Although that's not till later on you start figuring out what's actually happening in the town. And the ending of this movie is thoroughly confusing, to me at least. I definitely needed some further research to understand exactly what was happening, but I mostly got it. It's sort of a science fiction thing as well, which, based on what I've been saying so far, you probably wouldn't have gathered. But he's... Now I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. But he's getting these messages from the future or something like that that are warning him. And he's trying to decide, like, okay, is this even possible? What am I seeing here? Am I just having a mental breakdown? Or am I actually being led to stop a great calamity that I'm being told is happening? So this big event is incoming and he knows about it. And he's trying to figure out if he's crazy enough to stop it from happening. But he sort of has to ruin his reputation to do it, in a way. Must see, for sure. I think it's just a great movie. I also watched The Simpsons, season 12. And at this point in the show, I can tell the laughs per minute ratio is ever decreasing. But I still get a good chuckle, at least once per episode. It's still funnier in season 12 than most comedies are in their best years. Although at this point, the biggest problem with it is that the stakes are effectively non-existent. And the show has multiple meta jokes alluding to this fact. The plot lines are more and more outlandish and the character work is less fulfilling. They just throw everything at the wall and it could be the craziest thing ever. And then we'll just revert back to status quo like nothing happened. And the show always did that. But they're doing it more and more whilst acknowledging it at the same time. I can't call it a slap in the face because it's a comedy show. And you know, I already know it's got 20 years past this. I don't really care. But I can see why people were getting frustrated with it at this point. Because The Simpsons always used to have this grounding in character that was always the forefront of the show, is whatever lessons they were learning or growing as human beings, or lesson of the week sometimes, but there was always a nice grounded component to the family, or something you could take away from it. But now it's just more, all right, goofy comedy for comedy's sake. It's still pretty good. It's very entertaining, but it's not as heartfelt as it used to be. You're next.
So I've been trying to watch Sweet Tooth season 2. I'm a little behind on it because I didn't have Netflix for a while. It's a Netflix original. The first season was phenomenal. I definitely recommend that one. And it doesn't quite wrap its story up in the first season. It does have a carry on, but also I feel like you could just watch just the first season. It's that good that even if the other two seasons after it are terrible, I would still recommend watching the first season because it's very, very well done. Season 2, I'm having an issue with because they've got all these child actors now. It went from one child actor who was pretty good for a child actor. He was very good and like a teenager, and then like a middle-aged man, right? Were the three core in the first season. And that worked really well. The child actor was just, you know what? He was really good. He did a good job. Now he's the oldest in the first three or four episodes I've seen so far. He's the oldest, and there's a whole bunch of other kids, and they're just not as good. And it went from season one being fairly dark and into something that's different. Like, I'm not sure who the audience is aimed at, and it maybe it's because they're working with all the child actors that they just couldn't get away with doing something, as you know, in the same style.
Child labor laws and whatnot.
But I'm hoping,
you know.
Yeah, I had to Google it because I was like, I don't know. It got renewed for the third season. The third season is out and people are saying it's pretty good. But I had to check. I'm like, okay, does it get better? Because this is pretty painful. I'm not gonna lie. I'm struggling to get through it. That's why I'm still only on like the fourth episode. I probably will push through it to watch the rest, because people say it gets better after the fourth or fifth episode. It transitions back to older characters, and it picks up kind of where it was, and more return to what the show was. And the third season is reviewed pretty highly as well. So hopefully that'll return to form.
All right, not familiar with that one so much myself, but for your sake, I hope it gets better. My next one here is season two of the 1990s X-Men show. All right, so the overall villain for this season, Mr. Sinister, that's a miss. I didn't care about Mr. Sinister at all. I also didn't really care for the whole Savage Lands plotline, where Magneto and Professor X are just trapped there all season, and the X-Men, they're doing death-defying things every episode. It's getting crazy. And every episode, the X-Men are basically like, where's Professor Xavier? Oh, he left without saying goodbye, but he's probably doing something for a reason. It's okay. He'll get back when he gets back, and then it just like cuts to him nearly dying on the island. Ah, help the X-Men find me! Like, that was just all season. What I associate season two more with, though, is this is the season where basically every core member of the X-Men team got their own backstory episode, either one which explained what happened to them or actively showed us what happened to them, oftentimes a little bit of both. Often it was a past is coming back to haunt me in the present sort of deal. The show does this weird thing with its scripting where characters will talk about things like we're supposed to have seen them before, but actually happened off screen. So sometimes it confuses me. I'm like, are they addressing a plot line that I just don't remember? Oh, no, this is something that's happened to the characters that wasn't on the show. Got it. Which, all right, I'll call that world building. I do appreciate that they insinuate more happens than we see. It's just a little confusing how casually they do it sometimes. Like, it should be a reference, but it isn't. Season two, on the whole, definitely a downgrade from the inaugural year, but some great episodes in there. Season two of X-Men 1990 show is worth a watch. And my next movie here is Days of Thunder, which, speaking of that 1980s book, it just reminds me, I watched a Patrick H. Willems video essay on Days of Thunder recently, where he effectively proclaimed Days of Thunder killed the 1980s. He made a compelling argument for that. Generally speaking, it was just kind of boring. But it had me at the start. It was cool. But boring. It was basically all it is this cocky, hotshot driver gets a chance to be a driver at I don't even remember what it was now. I think it's Indy 500 or something. Racing fans are going to hate me on this. I don't even remember which kind of racing it was. But he's trying to be a professional racer. And all the problems that are associated with that. Oh, it's a dangerous sport. You could get hurt. And, oh, he really is, he doesn't really know a heck of a lot about the cars. So he keeps destroying the cars. And you're like, stop that. Learn how to, like, you're good in many ways. But actually learn how to handle these things properly. Because he comes from a different kind of racing. So he's not used to handling the cars in this style of racing. But yeah, Tom Cruise's main character there is just thinly written, and so is Nicole Kidman, who she's severely underwritten. She's just effectively the love interest, and that's it. Michael Rooker's plot was pretty good. That was all right. It's, that was the one about, well, I won't spoil it, but, his was pretty compelling for the back half of the movie. Robert Duvall was the only thing worth seeing about this movie as Tom Cruise's mentor character, the guy who designs and repairs the cars. He's got a great three-dimensional character going, and I don't think that was really the script so much as the depth of life experiences he imbues into this guy that made him so interesting to watch. And he's got good chemistry with Tom Cruise on screen. They were good together. The races are fun on the whole, too. It's a well-directed movie. It's just underwritten and just dull. But it's all right if you turn off your brain and just watch the racing scenes and Robert Duvall in the background. What you got?
Well, I got back into playing Warframe for the Whispers in the Walls update. For those of you who don't know, Warframe is a fast-paced, third-person action shooter. It's a mix between a shooter and, like, a melee, but you're basically playing mechs that move, like, human-sized mechs that move extremely fast, and it's just a satisfying game to play. It's kind of like, if anybody's played Destiny, it's like that, but good. So with the Whispers in the Walls update, it was a big update because in the game there used to be three factions, I believe, and they added an entirely new faction and a whole new set of stuff. So it was a really, really big update. And yeah, they nailed it. The characters, the NPCs you talk to, they're all pretty interesting. They all kind of have their own little story going on. And the enemies, they really varied them up this time. Your typical builds that Warframe is all about building and modding your mech to be the most effective, and you gotta change your stuff depending on what you're doing, right? And for the most part, you could get away with one build to do all three factions. You know, you're not the most effective. This one, they really changed it up. You actually had to spend a lot of time to figure out what you were doing because they were so different. And this is end game content too. So they've made it very challenging, and it's extremely fun to play. It's great. I'm really happy with what they did with it. And I'm looking forward to, there's two new updates that, not as big, they've added small expansions to this, and I'm looking forward to playing those ones when I get the chance soon. But so far for Whispers in the Walls, it's been pretty good.
I don't know what most people see in this game, but it seems to me you get a pretty big kick out of just building your Warframes and finding the ideal combinations with which to kick the most ass. Because it's pretty...
Oh, yeah,
it's definitely a lot more intricate than it seems on paper.
It's very intricate. There's a whole section for testing your builds. Like, you go in and have, like, a, you know, oh, I need to set up these types of enemies, and you know, you can make the move, or you have them pause just to test the way you're building stuff. There's, like, a bazillion combinations of stuff. There's like, 30-plus Warframes with all different customizations in there, and bazillions of different mods and all sorts of parts. It is a free-to-play game, but they don't really push you to pay for anything. It actually flows pretty good without having to pay for anything. You can get all the way through the game without paying. There's only one patch in it that everybody argues is really painful to do the grind through, which I did the grind and it sucked. But they've been talking about changing that and fixing that. So once they fix that, it's for new players to get into it. Yeah, it's worth it.
Cool.
But even still, you can play. That's still coming to the end of the game where you get stuck in that really grindy section before getting to Whispers in the Wall.
You've been on Warframe since pretty well the very start, right?
Yeah, I started playing it. I think it had been out for like a year or two when I started, and then I took a big gap between playing it because, you know, there wasn't that much to it. It was fun, but it gets repetitive after a while. And then I got back into it for this update, so there was a lot of new content for me to go over, and then I got into the really new stuff, and no, it was good. I played it for, I've put a lot of hours into it between the multiple different times that I've played it, so.
Nice. All right, so the other month I watched The Age of Adeline, and I was mostly intrigued by this movie because I watched a clip on Facebook about it where it was, well, I don't want to get too far into the plot, but it was just a very intriguing clip that made me say, I kind of want to see what this movie is about. So effectively, Adeline is... She got into an accident at some point when she was a young woman, and it pretty well turned her into an ageless immortal. So she's lived through most of the 20th century never having aged. And I think it's every 5 years she packs up her things and moves somewhere else. And just cuts out everybody she knows, except for her daughter, who is turned into an old woman by this point. But her daughter is the only one who knows who she really is. Blake Lively is spectacular in this role. I love her acting choices in the film, down to her voice, which sort of even sounds like a 1920s accent, which is... Because Adeline's from, she was from the 20s. So it was just details like that, which made it such a cool character. And I was mostly waiting for Harrison Ford because he was in that clip I saw. And he doesn't show up for a very, very long time. But he's great when he finally does. The guy who's playing Adeline's boyfriend in the movie... yeah, that character is kind of a stalker. He's portrayed as a romantic, but he's pretty much just a stalker. It's a little creepy, but he seems like an okay guy on the whole, I guess. It's just, okay, the plot is your acting is making you more charming than this guy is on paper. So it's like a sci-fi romance movie. It's mostly the romance. It's mostly about Adeline dealing with the existential dread of being this old woman who never gets to settle down anywhere just by virtue of having to outgrow everyone she loves. It's those heady sci-fi elements I was interested in more than the romance part of it, but that basically the romance effectively drives the plot, so... You got to be buckled in for that. But it's worth a watch. It's just an interesting sci-fi movie. And, you know, sci-fi romance isn't normally something I see combined quite like this. So it's unique, definitely. And for something pretty different, I finished season one of Dimension 20's Fantasy High show. I haven't talked about Critical Role in a while, but I'm only mentioning it now because, just to remind you guys that I do watch D&D live streams, but, well, not really even live streams, but I listen to them in audio form, though, not the visuals, which I know I'm missing quite a bit by not watching a show like Dimension 20 in video form because of their very elaborate sets that they've designed and whatnot. That's pretty essential viewing for a lot of people who enjoy Dimension 20, but I just hear it through my ears and soak in the story of it all and the hilarious lines of dialogue improvised by some of the best improv comedians entertaining today on Dropout. They're just really fun episodes. I believe the premise was roughly John Hughes in a medieval fantasy world, although it's not so much medieval because it's more like a 1950s to 80s town that has strong fantasy elements to it. Like, you know, one of the characters has got a gun and all that. But so it's basically a John Hughes movie. It's a small town. All these kids are going into freshman year at the Eggford Adventuring Academy and just spending this year learning who they are, getting into Breakfast Club kind of shenanigans where they all meet in detention and become an adventuring party together, investigate a conspiracy in the town, wire all these high school girls going missing, and lots of twists and turns and hilarity and running gags. The characters are very well developed, which, despite all this being improvised, makes for incredible stories that are shockingly tight. That's one thing I'll give this show over something like Critical Role, is that they managed to pack a lot into 2 hours, and then they finished the story in 17 episodes. 17 tight episodes for season one, where a campaign of Critical Role can go on for 100 plus episodes and have a lot more, I'll say, filler in it. I don't know what it is about Brennan. It's a different kind of show, but I'm just comparing to the one people know the most. Brendan Lee Mulligan is one of my favorite just personalities out there in entertainment, and him running, he's a genius, and just getting to see that man work is worth the price of admission to me for a series like this. I'm looking forward to seeing more Dimension 20 shows. I'm about to start listening to The Escape from Bloodkeep and looking forward to more Fantasy High seasons when I finally get there. It's a Dimension 20 is a watch ASAP for fantasy story fans.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that sentiment about Dimension 20 versus Critical Role. When I watch Matt Mercer run his games, those are games that I would want to play in. He's a very, very good DM. Whereas yeah. Brennan Lee Mulligan runs a game that would be fun to play, but is also really tight and really,
it's efficient,
entertaining for the audience. It's very, very well put together. Not that Critical Role is not entertaining, but it's not as,
it's different,
roped in and cleaned up. It's totally different. Like, Yeah, they have two very different styles of how they run those games. And it's pretty interesting going back and forth between the two to see, you know, how each DM style kind of can change things, right?
You know, I'll tell you the difference between what it is. Critical Role is basically a home game that was brought onto a live stream. So you kind of get the flaws of a home game. They're voice actors, so their strength is in creating their characters to be unique and recognizable. And it's a lot of banter and just friends being friends at the table is what Critical Role is. Dimension 20 is a live improv show where they just don't change the prompts. They just keep going for 2 hours and stay in consistent roles. It's a bunch of improv comedians doing a live show. That's what Dimension 20 is. And Critical Role is just a bunch of friends making funny voices and playing make-believe. Like, Dimension 20 is that, too. Like, they have a lot of similarities, but that's really the core difference to me is Critical Role is more about the cast dynamics and Dimension 20 is more about just the craziness of the improv. Yeah. That's my assessment of it for now. It might change over time. So what you got?
Well, I got back into another game that I haven't played in a really long time, which was No Man's Sky, which I played at the initial release and, like many other people, was severely disappointed in the game and stopped playing it. Mm. Now, they've been updating it continuously, and it's actually turned into a really, really good game. It's fantastic. They have these expeditions that release every once in a while with the new updates and stuff. So I've played through three of those, and that kind of takes you on like a almost like a guided tour in a way, because No Man's Sky is all about discovering in this vast universe of bazillions and bazillions of planets. Like, you literally go to places that nobody has ever seen before. And you can, you know, you claim it as your discovery and everything.
In a shared but online when it comes universe, to the that's the impressive thing.
So everybody's working together. There's even a counter online for how much has been discovered in the main universe. They have more universes just so it's like a never-ending playground, essentially. But the core universe, the game's been running for like, what, 8 years? And they're like, oh yeah, it's only like 30% discovered or something. But so playing the expeditions with these new updates is interesting because it's like a guided tour. Everybody gets starts on the same planet when you go to the hub and you're like, okay, I'm gonna play the expedition. And these are timed events. Like, I can't go back and play these ones again. They have a new expedition. There's always one running, but you can't go back and play the same one. So it's pretty interesting. But everybody starts on the same planet and is following the same relative path. Like, there's rendezvous points. So you might go a different path between, like, 6 or 7 planets. But eventually you're lining up with the same planets as everybody else. So it's kind of like a guided tour. They want you to go to specific planets. And in a way, it's showing off features of the new updates because they've picked these planets well. They've specifically picked out the path they want to take you on to show off what's been added in the new update. And it's interesting because they make you play through, and it's really fun because every time something gets added, you get to see a lot of the content by playing through that. And they sometimes tell their own self-contained stories. Like, since I've been playing again, I played through Adrift, which was a very hyped up update where instead of going through a galaxy that's populated by people, it's completely empty. Like, the planets and stuff are not typically full of life. Like, there's full of life, but not people all the time. Yeah. But there's random settlements and stuff. In Adrift, there was nothing. There was, like, abandoned settlements, the system stations were completely empty, and it was very unique, and it told a story of how this universe, the people disappeared, basically. It told a story about that, and it was really, really interesting, that one.
Yeah.
And then I played through Liquidators, which was essentially like Starship Troopers, basically. Mm. So they added a whole bunch of new functions for firepower and weaponry and stuff, which there wasn't a lot. Like, it was in the game, but it wasn't really a focus. So they started adding more weaponry, and your mechs were more designed for killing things and destroying bugs and stuff. And that one was really cool because, you know, it told the story. You were basically always one step behind where the actual liquidators were supposed to be. And it's like, yeah, great, we cleared the planet. And you're like, oh, I missed it. So that was a fun one. And then the latest one was Aquarius, where they added fishing. And you followed this angler guy, and you had to do all these types of fishing things. You had to build bases, and, you know, they run you through all the new stuff, and it's actually surprisingly fun. You know, I don't always get why they add, like, something like, oh, why are you gonna add fishing to it? Fishing is somehow fun in this game. The amount of variation in fish, and there's something about it that's just entertaining, especially that they really vamped up the water effects in the game now. So, like, the oceans are very dynamic, and it used to be planets that had, like, oceans on them were basically like ocean planets. Like, they were more like Kamino, basically.
Right.
Like,
right.
You had your small outcroppings of land, but it was mostly ocean, where now there's planets that are more like Earth, for example, right? Where it's blended, you know, you can find pockets where there's water, there's lakes and stuff, but then there is also sections of the planet that are oceans. So they've really diversified what the planets could do. And unfortunately, basically, with this update, the world's update, they called it, it kind of repopulated every single planet. So people who had their bases on stuff, you know, they come back and they're like, oh, my planet is not, it used to be color schemed like all nice, and now it's like a lava planet. Well, that was a sacrifice. Everybody was kind of on the fence on it, but they're like, you know what, we accept that. And it's turned the game really, really unique. It's very interesting. Every planet is really cool, and it's a game about discovery, so constantly changing things up makes it even more fun to go back to.
Yeah, I always respected No Man's Sky for, despite being a disappointment on launch, it turned itself around to the point where today it's the game we all wanted 8 years ago, and then some. It's one of those rare but hopeful turnaround stories for video games. The other month, I watched The Devil Wears Prada. And this one, for me, was one of those great confluences of, I saw this movie at the right time in my life, because I related very strongly to Andrea in this movie for what I gather is the main theme of work-life balance and, or the lack thereof, work-life balance. Because that's where I'm at right now is that something I'm struggling a lot with. So to see this film and, you know, an extreme version of that, it just gives me, it's one of those things where, okay, yeah, the theme is hitting me just in the right way here. But at least my bosses aren't as harsh as Miranda, you being one of them. you're no Meryl Streep in this movie, I will say. That's a good thing. She's very harsh. Actually, now come to think of it, you're very particular about many things as well.
Oh no.
Do things in this very specific way. Yeah, but Miranda is a very knowledgeable boss. For sure. She knows what she's talking about. Everyone's like, wow, why aren't you kicking your, like, why aren't you more happy to be working in a place like this? She's so knowledgeable and prestigious in her industry. And it's about Anne Hathaway's character, who never really gave a crap about fashion, coming into her own in this place. She becomes the personal assistant to this fashion mogul and sort of gets molded by her to become the perfect employee at this place through a combination of a lot of social pressure and her own drive to pick up some areas of her life where she's lacking. And it did definitely give me a greater appreciation for fashion, not so much the fashion industry, but just more the idea that clothes directly impact people's behavior. When people look good, they feel good. And when they feel good, they gain confidence. What you wear is important in as far as a factor in how you conduct yourself in daily life goes. And you know, that's a lesson Anne Hathaway learned, and also the work-life balance thing. I also watched a documentary called Senior, which was sort of a collaborative documentary with his father. It's about the legacy of Robert Downey Sr. and his career as a filmmaker, and Robert Downey Jr. reflecting on how his father's career in film impacted his life personally and his relationship with his father. And well, the first roles Robert Downey Jr. ever had were in his father's films, and they show some clips of that too. But it's also a tragic movie too, because as the movie's going, Robert Downey Sr., his health is deteriorating. So by the start of the movie, he's this very personable artist who is electrifying to watch, and then later he's just getting more sick and reflecting on his own legacy and what he's leaving behind. And you have to see Robert Downey Jr. document the deterioration of his father at the same time. There's a lot in here about legacy and boundary pushing artistry. I never watched a Robert Downey Sr. movie, but this documentary certainly makes me want to try. The clips they showed from his old movies seem right up my alley in terms of comedy and strangeness. They were just very unique from the looks of things and quite ahead of their time. So this was a good retrospective on a man I didn't really know anything about. And just a good documentary about a father and son. What's next?
So recently I have been playing, actually just today I finished the final DLC of Final Fantasy 15.
Oh, yeah.
I'm definitely late to the party on this game, but it was included on PlayStation Plus, so, you know, I've had it in my catalog. I'm like, yeah, I'll play it eventually. I really, really like this game. It's great. The characters are all phenomenal. So much so that the pack that we were given on PlayStation came with the three core DLCs, and then there was a fourth one that released, and I'm not usually a person who buys DLC because I believe that it should be included with the base game.
Yep.
I never find that DLC is that, you know, it should have been in the game in the first place, right?
Yeah.
This time, I enjoyed the DLCs so much. Well, two out of three. The middle one was okay. But two out of three were so good that I actually bought the last DLC, and it was excellent as well. I just finished it just today. And the game itself is really well done. It's basically the four characters go on a road trip before the main character's wedding, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a boys' trip. They go out, and during that trip is when everything kind of falls apart, and the core of the game kicks off. But throughout the game, it still kind of has that vibe that it's just a boys' road trip. I mean, there's some heavy topics in it, and everything like that. But it still feels like a road trip until you get to the wedding, and I'm not gonna spoil too much because that's essentially the road trip, despite it being half the game, is almost like a tutorial for the back half. And it's like a game that was, the first half is an open world and the second half is more linear. And I was really fascinated how they did that, because they used the open world to make you really understand and get the characters before just throwing you into the story, right? So it's really like, at first I wasn't really getting it when I played it, because I was like, I don't feel like the story's progressing. I don't feel like anything's happening. I don't really understand what I'm doing, and I feel I'm quite far into the game. What, you know, why don't I get it? And then, you know, then it was really fun to play, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna keep playing it. And that halfway point is when you realize, you're like, oh, this is a really smart way of storytelling, because I find with a lot of games, they throw you in and it's like, oh no, the protagonists, you know, for example, it could be like the protagonist's mom dies or something. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up right now.
Yeah.
But it's like, you don't care. You're like, I don't know who this character is, and I don't know who their mom is. I don't really care. Right?
Yeah.
And this way of storytelling made you take that time to really fall in love with each and every single one of the characters and really understand the characters. And in the back half, there's still characters that you never met, and you still, you don't really, it's the same thing, you don't really care about them that much, but your core four, you really care about because of that first half of the game. It really feels like you've had these friends for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So it really makes the true story really shine, because you know these characters, you know the relationships, you almost feel like you have a relationship with them yourself. So it makes the storytelling itself really effective.
Seems like a pretty cool way to go about things. Definitely. I watched Juno, which made me feel things. Which is weird. I don't feel things watching movies. I'm a cold and emotionally repressed person. I don't feel things, but I like Juno. I was very invested in the characters and their world. Everyone's just very likable in this movie, and the script and the actors convey a lot of complex emotions about this subject matter of teen pregnancy and all the pitfalls that brings along with it. It's a very well-written movie. And it's also a refreshingly low budget from what I'm used to of late. I'm used to every movie trying to look as expensive as possible, but this didn't look like it broke anybody's bank and still looked pretty good at doing it. I miss low to mid budget movies like this in the mainstream. I like the color palette quite a bit too. It was very bright and eye-catching, and the soundtrack was pretty famous, I believe, just for its quirkiness, which fully represents the movie. It's pretty darn good, for sure. I also watched Star Trek IV. Oh, sorry, you want to talk about Juno?
I've
seen this one.
I've seen Juno. It's a long time ago, and it's one of those ones where it kind of redefined that like little subgenre of the kind of weird things. So yeah. That soundtrack has, you know, a lot of things you watch today that have that same vibe fall back on that style of soundtrack because of that movie. It really pushed that style around, and you'll see it a lot in especially things that I like to watch, because that's kind of in my vein there. But yeah, it's definitely still felt throughout. It's really inspired that, especially the music is what really carried forward into that little subgenre even to this date. So it's a very, very good movie for even just looking at like movie history stuff.
It definitely represents a time and place. I feel the vibe of it. It's like, yeah, that reminds me of our childhood, roughly around that era. I wasn't Juno's age at that point, but I kind of remember things like that. Joe from the future here, just interjecting quick. This episode, as most of these leisure lists do, ran on quite a bit longer than intended. So this time, we're going to split them into two episodes. This one, obviously, the one you're listening to, and the next one, hopefully, will come out. May not be the next one, might be the one after that, so be on the lookout. All right, back to the episode. Finale. All right, that does it for another installment of Leisure Lists. All right, where can we find you?
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm and on YouTube at ThoughtPlane Media.
All right, you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. We hope to see you on the next Close Up with Ryan and Joe. And give Justin a big round of applause once again for being a great guest star. Till next time.
Take care.